Father, thank you so much for this time this morning together, that we can come to your word, so that you would just nurture us, encourage us, grow us, and just draw closer to you through your word, God. Thank you for these words of life that you give us that are the very words we need to live and to know you. Just pray for everybody that is here. Bless us through it. Everybody that's not here, protect them and bless them. And I pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay. We are going to open to Judges chapter 13. We have chapter 13, 14, and 15. So three chapters, which is a lot. We will read some of it because it's a story form, and it's kind of, I'm going to know the story. Mm-hmm. So, but if it gets too much, it'll take a little time. So if you have your Bible or your phone Bible, we'll be in 13. And so we'll start this first. What we're doing is just going to keep something from today is kind of like the birth of Samson and then the outworking of his life to become a judge, and then next week will be the destruction of Samson. So, like, crash landing. But I think today's study is just great stuff in here. And I mean, yeah, it's good. So, let's start with the birth of Samson. And just his parallels, it's odd. You know how it spirals downward in Judges? So, it's like he's kind of the worst judge, and things are getting worse. And yet there's still such very clear parallels from Samson to Christ. Mm-hmm. The least deserving person, you know, and yet the parallel between him and Jesus is crazy. So the first four verses of 13. And the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, for the Lord gave them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. There was a certain man of Zorah of the tribe of the Danites, whose name was Manoah. So that's the tribe of Dan, so these are Israelites. And his wife was barren and had no children. And the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, "Behold, are you barren and have not born children? Oh, you are barren and have not born children, but you shall conceive and bear a son. Therefore, be careful and drink no wine or strong drink and eat nothing unclean." And it goes on to the doubt. But so the birth is foretold. Actually, I want to read verse 5. "For behold, you shall conceive and bear a son. No razor shall come upon his head, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to save Israel from the hands of the Philistines." There's a telling by the angel coming to tell her and foretell this birth of a baby, and a few more to go, but also with the promise that God's going to begin to save Israel from the hands. So there's such little, like, from the get-go, like, it's going to start to this whole, like, coming and saying, there's a baby that's coming. And that's going to save his people through the baby, or begin to save his people through an unexpected and miraculous baby. So that's what we see, is that God has a plan here, and he's bringing a baby about to do it with his angels. We will get more into the things like that Nazarite vow. We'll talk more about that in a minute. That verse 1 about the cycle and then doing evil, and we'll come back to that. So know that we're kind of hitting some of the narrative, but we're not going to skip over those things. Alright, so now they see in her husband, there are Israelites here under the rule of the Philistines, people of God, and they're being coached by this angel, even though they have no expectation of the baby, because we are, in fact, going to have a baby, and it will be through this baby that God does something. So they have this encounter with the angel of the Lord, and we'll see stuff through her husband. It's kind of neat to see how her husband relates to the angel and what he asks. So let's read a little bit more. We'll start in verse 6. "Then the woman came and told her husband, 'A man of God came to me, and his appearance was like the appearance of the angel of God. Very awesome. I did not ask him where he was from, and he did not tell me his name. But he said to me, "Behold, you shall conceive and bear a son. So then drink no wine or strong drink, and eat nothing unclean. For the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb to the day of his death." Then Manoah prayed. So she repeated what was said. And so she prays to the Lord and says, "O Lord, please let the man of God whom you sent come again to us and teach us what we are to do with this child who will be born." He wants more information. He's like, what are we going to do? How are we going to care for this child? What's your purpose? He wants to understand God's purpose more for this child. But clearly, he told my wife, he has faith that God's going to do it. But he's like, Lord, please send him back. Give me more information. I need to know what he's going to do and how you're going to do this and how what you want to do with it. And God listened to the voice of Manoah, and the angel of God came again to the woman as she sat in the field. But Manoah, her husband, was not with her. So he's the one that wants the info. The angel comes back to her. The woman runs quickly and tells her husband, "Behold, the man who came to me the other day has appeared to me." And Manoah arose and went after his wife and came to the man and said to him, "Are you the man who spoke to this woman?" And he said, "I am." And Manoah said, "Now, when your words come true, what is to be the child's manner of life? What is his message? What's interesting about him?" And the angel would say to Manoah, "Of all that I've said to the woman, let her be careful. She may not eat of anything that comes from the vine. Neither let her drink wine or strong drink or eat any unclean thing. All that I command her, let her observe." So he repeats first what he already said. He repeats, "And I told her to eat. She needs to have this now, from there." And then I was like, "Right, what do you want to do with him?" Like, "Right, what's your plan for him? You know, he wants to still understand more." So we'll keep going. So Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, "Please, let us detain you and prepare a young goat for you." It's not uncommon, like Abraham had set a meal to the angel of the Lord. So that's not uncommon, to have a meal together. The angel of the Lord said to Manoah, "If you detain me, I will not eat of your food. But if you prepare a burnt offering, then offer it to the Lord." So for Manoah did not know that he was the angel of the Lord. And Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, "Well, what is your name, so that when your words come true, that we may honor you?" He says, "How about just your name?" And the angel of the Lord said to him, "Well, how do you ask my name, seeing that it's wonderful?" So right there, Manoah just wants more information. He wants to understand. And the angel, she didn't reveal any more. Manoah was scared the angel, but the angel did not. He asked him his name. The name wasn't given. And so we'll see what happens next. But right now, you're at this, like, it's not, it's a genuine thing. He just genuinely wants more understanding. It doesn't seem like he does trust God. He believes him. He had faith to say, "Okay, we're going to have this son. Now what do we do?" So this isn't a lack of faith, but it is more than God wanted to reveal. So I put on here a page ground I heard last week to say this, and I thought, oh, so good. Even when God doesn't tell us anything we want to know, he has told us everything we need to know. And just that reality that even here, God didn't tell Manoah what he wanted to know, but he told him everything. When I was single, like all through my 20s, and especially getting like later 20s, I just wanted to know, and I would tell you, Lord, like, if I just knew I was married, you don't have to tell me when. Like, it could be like when I'm 68, when I'm 7. I don't care when. If you could just tell me, I'll get married. I'll be happy. And that was my bargain all the time. Like, if I knew that truth, I could be completely fine. Which is not true. It's certainly a different way that he would tell me, is that he would be enough. He was there. There was purpose. He was using it, you know? And so there's that, like, even when God doesn't tell us anything, even if he doesn't tell us anything, he doesn't know anything extra. He doesn't know everything. Tim Keller here, you see it, he says, "If there's this reward of saying to Manoah, you need to know me and my character far more than you need more information. All the rules in the world, if you cannot say how to raise the son, what's your purpose so you can really do it all just right? Because all the rules in the world will not be able to give you the direction and the innumerable decisions and choices you're going to have to make as you can. Only a deep understanding of who I am can give you the guidance you need." So Tim goes on to say that we think we need rules, but we need to know God. God does not and will not give us a guidebook for every twist and turn, every doubt and decision in our life. He gives us something much better. He gives us himself. I remember years ago in a conversation with a woman on a mission trip, and Terry Horsley was one of my church companions. I said, I'm like, it could be so much easier if it was just a formula, you know, like this award. And she's like, what is this one? Like, he gave us the spirit. That's evidence A. It's not a formula. It's a walking in his spirit. There's no formula because it's just complete dependence on him. But he gives us him and his spirit. I'm just thinking, like, if we do have him, we have this ingrained spirit of his standards to him. And all we need is asking him to listen, asking him to come, asking him for peace, you know, the peace one. It's like, he has it in you, but all we need is asking him and sitting with him and listening, you know. And like, that's kind of the first little thing we see. So now the end of their encounter with the angel. You'll see the sacrifice they made on this chart. Verse 19. So Manoah took the young goat with a grain offering, and he offered it on the rock to the Lord, to the one who works wonders, and Manoah and his wife were weeping. And when the flame went up toward heaven from the altar, the angel of the Lord went up in the flame of the altar. Now Manoah and his wife were walking, and they fell on their faces to the ground. The angel of the Lord appeared no more to Manoah and his wife. Then Manoah knew that he was the angel of the Lord, and he said to his wife, "We shall surely die, for we have seen God." But his wife said to him, "If the Lord had meant to kill us, he would not have accepted a burnt offering and a grain offering at our hands, or shown us all these things, or now announced to us these things." Thank you all. They fell and worshipped Manoah expected a certain death, because he realized that angel was God's people. It was a manifestation, an incarnation of God himself, the angel of the Lord, with that capital Lord. Like one of those, you know, the Old Testament, it's like Jesus, and we were seeing that, that's like, there's probably Jesus coming to encounter somebody. They saw God himself, and he realizes that. So here's one more, this is a quote from a different commentator, no, from Ralph Davis, who we use a lot. He says, "Be wary not to think Manoah too extreme. Manoah understood perfectly and intended. We must allow Manoah to be the teacher. Whereas he may not have been wrong in his inference that they were going to die. He was like, 'We're dying, we're going to die, we're dead,' you know? Okay, no, he was right in his inference. So where did we ever get the idea that the presence of God is not dangerous?" And this is Exodus 33 with Moses, he got 26. His wife understood, though, it was not the purpose of God at this time to consume them, but to preserve them. So she understood, God put, and she told him, "Oh, God took this up. He gave us a promise for a son." So she understood, God didn't want to consume us, he consumed that. He wanted to preserve us for this time. So she understood, even when they didn't have the full understanding of the sacrifice and the Jesus, what would come, she seems to have faith that God took that sacrifice for them. And then God took it for his promise. So Manoah had the reverence, but not the comfort. He had the fear, but not the faith. We need a properly balanced response to the presence of God. There's reverence and comfort. There's fear and joy. And he didn't have the balance. Dr. Davis says, "Saints easily err to extremes in this time." Great, that's the case. That he expected that he didn't, but the wife saw him. And then the end of that chapter is taken. The woman bore a son, and she thought of him sickly. And the young man grew, and he was with him. And the Spirit of the Lord began to stir him in Mahanadan, where they lived between Zerah and Ethbaal. So now there's a parallel, like the Lord grew, and the infection grew, and the Lord grew. And that's so simple. All we know of Jesus and his childhood, right? When we choose what to do, is like, and the boy grew, and grew and lived in stature, favor, and it's like, it's not exactly like that, but it's still like some sense of birth that was foretold until we see him like kind of as a young adult. This is what we know. He grew in the Lord. God's hand was upon him, and the Spirit of the Lord was beginning to stir him. So again, parallels to Jesus. The Nazarite vow, before the next chapter, just to give you a little more information, or a little more about that. Not questions, not words. It's a theological question, and it's like a sound theological encyclopedia. Yeah, it's like a very sound... Yeah, it's so simply like...
Yeah,
theologically sound question bank, like an encyclopedia for your theological questions. So I felt like it was the Nazarite vow. Okay, so Nazarite vow is talked about in like Numbers and Leviticus in the Old Testament. A lot more Numbers explained. But it's a totally voluntary decision laid out in Scripture that is like to make a human by man or a woman to have a, and it's for a set time, typically. It is meant to be like for a set period of time, you make a vow to completely consecrate yourself to the Lord for a season. It would typically be to say thank you for something that he's done. Like, oh my goodness, God has like women, especially if they were barren and then had a baby or after childbirth, might do it as a season of thankfulness. And during the vow, You have no wine, no grapes, no seeds of grapes, no anything to do with fermented grapes and wine. You don't cut your hair. And then the third thing is that you don't touch a dead animal. No interaction with a dead animal. So it's like three kind of things, but those are three little ways to say I'm going to completely stay clean in the day as a just consecrated to show you my thanks and my praise and my commitment here. And it would be for this little amount of time. There are, in the Old Testament, two people we know who did not voluntarily take this vow, but had it from birth for their whole life. And so Samson is one, the angel told his parents, he's been born under this vow. And so this is not just a temporary voluntary vow of eternity, it's a lifelong vow if he has to be set apart in this way. And so those three stipulations. And then Samuel, when Samuel was dedicated by his mom to the temple, he was dedicated completely under a sacred vow. So we know. Is that the hand?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Hannah, yes, so she was the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
It was normal for her to have made that vow. It would be normal because that's what the Lord did to her, a baby, for her to have had a time period where she made an accurate vow. But what she did is offer her son for a lifelong vow. And so he had that vow. So that's kind of where we always come with that vow. Questions helps a little bit with that. Okay, so chapter 14. Okay, so chapter 14, we're looking at the outworking of who Samson is, if he's kind of comes. We are going to read like little points into this, and 15 I'll probably summarize a lot as it gets long. But we can take little points just to see the story unfold, and then we'll get to the point. So hopefully that's good. We know that what we know about him is that he's a Nazarite from birth, so he's under the staff. So let's see the first four verses here. As he's now, he's kind of grown, you know, the spirit is moving in him. And so you have this young adult. So Samson in chapter 14 went down to Timnah, and at Timnah he saw one of the daughters of the Philistines. Then he came up and told his father and mother, I saw one of the daughters of the Philistines at Timnah. Now get her for me as my wife. But his father and mother said to him, is there not a woman among the daughters of your relatives or among all of our people that you must go and take from the uncircumcised Philistines? But Samson said to his father, get her for me, for she is right in my eyes. His father and mother did not know that it was from the Lord, but he was seeking an opportunity against the Philistines. At that time, the Philistines ruled over Israel. We will come back to that verse 4, because we're going to come back to see all that the Lord was doing throughout this time. But what we see about Samson, so we're just looking to pull out the outworking of his Samson is, he's driven by lust. He's a young man. He's demanding. He's driven by lust. He doesn't have regard for his parents. He's not, we don't see a submissive spirit to his parents. He does come tell them, but he tells them in a demanding way. So get me this woman, she's right in my eyes. I want her, I get her. You know, and when they're like, kind of feeling like, she's not one of us, she's uncircumcised, he just responds by saying, like, go get her for me. She's right, you know? So what that's the person we see is like, I think it's a lot of things. But it seems to be kind of been like what we call today, a narcissistic, like, I can have what I want, and I rule me. I rule me. You know, nobody else rules me. I'm driven, it'll come back more, but just a little bit. So, verse 5 through 7, let's see the next little piece of the story. Then Samson went down with his father and mother to Timnah, so they go together, and yet we see part of the story they're not together. And they came to the vineyards of Timnah, and behold, a young lion came towards him, roaring. Then the spirit of the Lord rushed upon him, and although he had nothing in his hand, he tore the lion in pieces, as one tears a young goat. But he did not tell his father or his mother what he had done. And then he went down and talked with a woman, and she was right. Okay, so there's this weird thing that the Lord sends the lion here, and then the Lord empowers him with this thing. But at the same time, he destroys the lion and kills it. Why would he not tell his parents that? That was the first secret that we see him keep. reveals a part of his bow, which is the third part of the line, not coming here, and then not keeping it back in. And so when he, with his hand, rips apart a line, even though God empowers him to do it, when he does that and acts out on shredding up this line, he has just broken that out. Okay, so he's now interacting with the dead animal. So that's the first step we see of him. He's broken his vow. And we would say he probably knows it because he didn't tell his father and mother. So there's evidence he's like, he knew what he did. He did it, and he's kind of proud, but also like, knows it's not right. So we kind of move through 8 and 9. After 10 days, he returned to take her, with the wife he wants, and he turned his head to see the carcass of the lion. And behold, there was a swarm of bees in the body of the lion. He scraped it out into his hands and went on, eating it as he went. And he came to his father and mother and gave some to them, and they ate. But he did not tell them that he scraped the honey from the carcass of the lion. It's a deeper dive into the thing. He knows he broke the vow. Kind of went. Seems like maybe it kind of caught him off guard, and he sort of almost accidentally did it. Well, now he passes that by the dead body. It's a carcass. It's disintegrated, and he goes straight up to it, touches it, gets honey out of it, walks around, you know, takes it with him, offers it to other people. He didn't actually get in. You can see the plummeting into a harder heart of, like, no regard. You know, their regard is just going for him. So, I don't know, there's something like, did that leave a parent to be sad, or more just that he was just, I guess at this point, not something dumb, because he got in there. But he's even giving it to them, knowing he touched it. He has kind of defamed it, you know, and then sharing it with them. Still not honor. It wouldn't honor them.
Yeah, okay.
It would be disappointing for their son. It's not honoring them to keep their time, but then also something that makes it mean for someone without knowing it. So the next, 17-19, we won't read, but okay, so he moves on, they're moving towards the wedding season of him to marry the Philistine. And he's just walking with this secret and this arrogant kind of attitude, which is a secret thing he's done. And he's really proud of it, but he's not sharing it. And so what he does is he goes to the men, there's 30 men I guess for their wedding, and he makes this where he's like, I'm going to give you a riddle. And then he solves my riddle. And the terms were so interesting. He was like, if they could not solve it, then they all 30 had to give him an item of clothing, like a linen garment, which is like a suit kind of like that. So like, he would get like 30 new suits from one from each of them. But if they did solve it, he had to give all 30 of them. Like, he was falling on debt. But he clearly doesn't think there's no way you can solve it. And it's just kind of like a way to manipulate and to flaunt his secret thing he's done. So he says, his riddle is, out of the eater came something to eat. Out of the strong came something to eat. He's ambiguous enough to know, and him to think, they're never going to know that this is out of a lion. They know, like, a well of honey. And all. So, his, we know one of the weaknesses is that whole lust for women. So this woman he's about to marry, he's betrothed, you know, fiance. These men are telling her, entice your husband, get him to tell us what the riddle is. Entice him, get him to tell us. And so she weeps over him, says, you hate me, you don't love me, you put this riddle to my people and you don't tell me. And we'll see the next week, you know. He's so easily manipulated, he's got this weakness for this woman. Maybe it's just this impatience, but he doesn't want to be mad, he doesn't want to have something bothering him. He's like, you don't love me. And so he tells her. He foolishly just tells her what it was. He hadn't even told his parents, because he hasn't told them, but he tells her. Right. So she, of course, tells him in. So then they solve his riddle, and he's just like, he's angry, he explodes, And so what he does, instead of go to get 30 garments, he goes and just violently kills 30 men to give them their names. He does fulfill that part of the bet to give it to them, but he does it in a violent, an explosion of anger before the actual wedding comes to fully finishes. And then he leaves and goes home sulking. So, talks about there at the very end of chapter 14, you know, the fear was left behind, he went down, he struck, so he had that spirit, that extra supernatural strength again when he struck down 30 men. And he took everything from him, and he went and gave it. In hot anger, he went back to his father's house. Okay, so he knew, so the family would assume he's so angry, he's not in the corner. He has now left, and is angry with all of us, the Philistines. So you see at the very end, and Samson's wife is given to his companion who had been with him. They so assume that he has gone that they give her away. So what we see is Samson is impulsive. He has no regard for his vow. He disrespects his parents. He's angry. He's violent even. He's full of lust. He has supernatural strength. And yet, he was used by God. He was not respected. He is who God used. We know this, and we're going to see it again, but this whole book, the theme of the book is mercy. But it seems so dark that it's like, this is a heavy dark, but it's not. The theme of this book is mercy. Because every page, every step is that God does merciful things that are under there. When I taught high school math for a season, and this is before I had kids, right before Bev was born. But some of those high school boys, I would say, they're literally pretty terrible. Like, very disrespectful at times. And watching them day in and day out, there's a certain group. Like, you know, different, like, classes might be, like, better or worse, and you get dynamics. But it was clear that I was just, like, I couldn't. I mean, I'll go home crying. I just, it was just awful. And I'm just saying, I never had a friend. I do not want a friend. Because it was, like, I just couldn't even have hope for these boys. So I thought, I don't, and I was so happy. Yeah, my first baby was a girl. And I was, like, right? He's, like, I wanted her to be a girl. Really bad. Even though I had three brothers. I just knew I wanted a girl. Because I always just thought there's just, how can God use it? And even one of the worst of the worst, he was like, I'm sexy, really, he's just a sucker, and he was having names with the people. And he went to Albion, and I remember one of those, he did not come back to me personally, but he came back a couple years when he was at Albion, and he came to the Lord. And he did come back and apologize to some other people in this very second year, because he used to be some places where he had been pretty terrible. And end up just having, like, and God used some of my friends, a couple of those guys, not say all of them, a couple of them the Lord got a hold of, and just used, you know, and they're all, like, mid-20s, and 27, and still getting married and dads, and, you know, and they're fine, they were using them, but I'm like, I remember that season, I just was like, nothing good can come from that, like, that's, I never want one of you. And I told him, I said, have you ever wanted one of you? And I just said, all I know to say is, I'm just going to say, if you have ruined me, I hope you are all very happy you have ruined me. And they were like, really? And I think they're proud. You know? Anyways. Yeah, that's the way it was back then. Okay, so that's kind of the first thing we see. The birth of Samson is told, the outworking he is. So now we'll look, and we're going to kind of look back through some of this. To see, did I not go back? No, I didn't see the serious stuff on here. Hang on, we gotta finish the story here. Okay, after the wedding, he does go back. I'm sorry, I totally forgot chapter 15. So I'll summarize this one. He goes back to that woman and says, and it says sometime later when the harvest time, so much later, he returns and is like, hey, I'm here for my wife. I want to go to her bedroom and tells her that, and her dad's like, No, I've already given her away, but you can have a more beautiful younger sister. So if Samson is driven by lust, he actually would think this would be a better, the younger, more beautiful sister. But he reacts in anger again this time. He is just, he is impulsive and distracted. And so he goes out and gets these foxes, 300 foxes, and he's like, and he gets the supernatural strength, torches them, they run through, and they destroy all of the grain, the Philistine grain. And so he does this, like, sends this consequence to the Philistines. So the Philistines want him to stop. And so they turn on their own and just stop Samson. The Philistines themselves burn that father and the daughter that he gave away. Burn them to death. The Philistines, their own people. So now there's two deaths that are really on circumstances that, on top of the 30s, that have now come into play, that, you know, it's just becoming more violent, and they're trying to calm his anger, and then, so what's there, undone, it says in the, 2 days, is where we are in verse 8 here, Samson said to them, if this is what you do, I swear I will be avenged on you, and after that I will quit. And he struck them, hit them by with great blows. So he just starts destroying more Philistines. And then he went down and stayed in the cleft of the rock of Edom. So he goes and hides in the cave after he has brought more destruction. There is great conflict found between the Philistines and him. They're bringing more conflict with each other, whereas they control it. He's hiding. He's now hiding in a cave just as it continues in between his own people, the men of Judah. So the tribe of Judah come and find him now, because the Philistines are now causing extra harshness on them. And so they come and they say, hey, we got to give you up, the Philistines. They're looking for you. You're hiding. It's coming out on us. It's kind of like the men throwing Jonah off the ship, you know? Like, we got to get out from under this. And you can, it's your fault. You're the one at fault, so we got to get you. So they take it, and he says, okay. And he lets them take it, and they give him over to the Philistines. So then once again, on verse 14, when he got to the Philistines, the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him, and the ropes that were on his became a flat. He caught fire, and his bonds melted off his hands. So he breaks through all of his strength, and that supernatural strength. And he found a fresh jawbone of a donkey, and he put out his hand, and this is another dead animal. And then with it, he struck 1,000 men. And Samson said, with the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey have I struck down 1,000 men. So he brings greater destruction that does give more freedom to the Israelites. Okay, it is, God is using it to deliver the Israelites from their roots. So as he is reacting out of anger and out of sinful things and out of a broken vow, also accomplishing the purpose that God has to set them free from this. So that's kind of where we are in the scene of like his. So then we get down, and it says, and he was after this, and he finished all this, and he destroyed the people, and he just caught him. Now he's very thirsty. And he called upon the Lord and said, you have granted this salvation by the hand of your servant, and shall I now die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised? It seems, at first thought, I thought he's praying. He's praying to God. He's asking God to be received. But the commentators say, he is a human. He is speaking so arrogant. The tone here is demanding God. I would use man. I know you said that, you know, obviously God has given him that strength. He did know that there was a supernatural strength. So he's like, you are doing it, so give me some water, because now I'm thirsty. So it's just this demanding. I grew up watching the show Full House as a kid, and Michelle, wasn't it one of the old girls was like, rude, or something like that. I don't know how they said it. I'm like, Jesus, and just, but, God provided. He gave him the water. Despite the obvious thing. We're going to come back to that. And then the last little verse here of our thing today is, and he judged Israel in the days of the 15th. So, the Lord had used him to judge. So now we're going back through to say that's kind of the story of the outworking of his life. Before we get to the end of Toy Decade, but who Israel was at this time, is what I want to make sure to mind. During this time, what we see from this text, going back to certain old things, is that Israel was virtually indistinguishable from the nations around them. The cycles were spiraling downward. They had been under the rule of other people and then cried out to the Lord in their distress. Like, I remember that the thing was, for this time, they didn't cry out. They didn't even realize. They are now so ingrained and ruled and lost their culture with faith. They don't even cry out. It said in that verse first of our whole thing in chapter 13 that they did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, not even what was right. And it says God's sight it was evil, but he didn't even have recognition that what they were doing. They were so far gone. It's not even a knowing disobedience anymore. It's just that they're so far gone. They've been let go. They're so ingrained. They didn't cry out. They're content to be enslaved. So it's like, if you picture this way, the Philistines were occupying their land. This would be the promised land God had given them. Remember the Danites, the tribe of Judah. These are the tribes of Israel, and so they're having this like occupation. When we think about the Nazi occupation, we have people and making and enforcing their rules and their culture. And isn't it something? They're happy with it. They see that they know that they are occupying this land, and they're not resisting it. This, it shows that it didn't offend them. That culture, that rule, it did not even offend them or threaten them. Which just feels like, remember, they were set apart to be the people to Yahweh. Yahweh gave them a land. He gave them that land. He provided it miraculously. Their ancestors, they were supposed to know this. This is the promised land that Yahweh provided for his people, this little milk and honey land. Israel. It's the gift. And the whole thing is to preserve and protect the land. And they're not even resistant. They're not even aware regarding protecting the whole point of being God's people. Like, that's literally the Israelites. Literally that. Like, that's who they are. They're the people of Yahweh to protect that promised land. That's their thing. And they were so far gone that they were giving up their land. They didn't mind other people ruling it. Not even me. They were just very frightened. That's what we see with the spiraling and the judges. So with that, the Israelites, no longer had a recognizable culture of their own. What we find is that they're on the very brink of extinction. This is the edge of extinction. They're not even trying anymore. And that this is where Yahweh raises up the Savior. In the past, he has called someone who's there. He's called, he would have called asking for someone to be a judge. He raises up that from the head and the devil didn't need this to be one. There's a quote, I think I put this on there, I don't know if I did, but there's just a couple different commentators, and this one was quoted by some fellas. He says, Michael Wilcox, that there is no such thing as harmonious coexistence between the system and the world. For where there is not conflict, it is because the world is different. There was no longer conflict. It was because the first one was. It wasn't because they were fine and just being at peace with it and everything else. When there's no longer conflict with the enemy, then it's we know Matthew 6 says, you can't say no one can say two masters. If you can't, possibly you will hate the one and serve the other. So one has taken over. And John 1:15, John says, do not love the world or the things in the world. If you love the world, the love of the Father is not in you. So here it is. The world has taken over. So that's what Israel is. So assimilated. Not even aware of the family. Not even. We're downward in our steps. And I say, they don't even try to ask. They don't even ask for the world. They don't acknowledge them. Now, it is interesting to see that there's that limit. It can't compare it. Clearly, they knew Yahweh. Because when it talks about them and then when the angel Lord came, they knew he was. They took him at his word. And he told them. So there is still a remnant of people who do know the Lord. Yet as a whole, there's not a resistance to the world, you know? So that's the thing where we are. So we're just ending with the fourth thing. This is what I like. I mean, all of it I like, but this 13th verse to me, it's supposed to be what God was doing, you know, through it. And then you back up the same and say, this is what God was doing. This is where Israel is. This is completely assimilated. But what was God doing? So, you know, that's the piece that we want to see. As always, God was accomplishing his purposes through the means that only he could have chosen and only he understood. All of the judges we see God took certain specific means that didn't make sense to anybody else. But that he chose and he understood. I caught some scripture just to remind us. In Psalm 33 of God's sovereignty, the Lord brings the counsel of the nations to nothing. He frustrates the plans of the people. The counsel of the Lord stands forever, and the plans of his heart to all generations. He's always accomplishing his purposes that never stop. No matter the political situation, the circumstance, something, he is at work. Isaiah 46:10-11, for I am God and there is no other. I am God and there is none like me. Declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times things not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand and I will accomplish all my purposes. So he is accomplishing the purposes. That's the main thing. We know that's what he's doing. So this story of Samson God is in the depths of the brokenness of people who don't even want it, for the most part. He is sending a message. He is writing a story. It's that whole tapestry. Kelly Buckle talked about the tapestry. God is weaving a beautiful tapestry, and we see the knot and the ties on the back. We see what he's doing, but God sees that tapestry he's making. That's what he's doing. He's at his plans and his tapestry. Are the people. We see the knot on the back and think it's that. So, a couple particular things here. Samson's parents were concerned about his desire to marry the Philistine woman. And that was good concern. He wasn't supposed to go in unmarried. That was good concern. But in their concern, God had a plan for Samson that was to begin to deliver the people from the rule of the Philistines. This was an ordained part of God's plan. So you're like, oh, if Samson's parents could have mentioned, so now you just think, as parents, you let them, like, oh, they were so brokenhearted and they're rightfully afraid. Yet, that was part of God's plan. You know, God was at work, even in the midst of his lust and his desire to go this route. God was going to use it. Tim Keller says God was rescuing his people by prompting conflict with their physical and spiritual masters. Because they Israelites weren't even in conflict, there was a conflict between them and the Philistines. They accepted their rule, and they were at peace with you. Samson, in his hot-headed temper, is actually his sin, is what stirred up conflict. You know, he got a wedding thing, he first wants to marry somebody, and it's like, okay, so he's going to marry, and he might be kind of what? He's probably trying to work the system and grow politically by marrying a Philistine or something. But through it, he does the riddle, his arrogance leads him to the riddle. Then they saw that all of his sin leads him to tell the world. You know, and all it comes to explosion, that's the start of the conflict. The first start of conflict between any Israelite and Philistine. He's got done wedding little explosion. And God is trying to stir up conflict here because his people are at peace with sin. And so he's trying to stir up a conflict that will ultimately bring about their freedom and their separation because when they take extension, the people who come to them change. You know, so he's trying to protect them, but he does it through stirring up conflict. Because he's a king. So he can't be. Okay, God not only used Samson in spite of his sin, but through his sin. One commentator reminds us that Judges, I've already said this, but it's above all a book about grace and undeserved mercy, as is the whole Bible. And that we can rejoice in the fact that God is also in the business of using our failures as the foundation for perfect success. Let us never imagine, he says, that we have God's hope, or that we know how he will work for them. As soon as we start to say, God cannot do this, or God will not do this, or he will not do this until he's blah, 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 we are wrong for this. We just do not understand the hands and mind of the Lord that he is using, even the messiest practices. We know that God raised up Samson from a baby to come with the judge to nothing. In Romans 4, there's this like sweet verse. If you flip to Romans 4 with me, but verse 17 about Abraham. And the reason this one's been sticking with me so much, and I thought, what is this, what God did with Samson, is he brings something out of nothing. In the midst of the last few months of my life and my marriage and just everything being so difficult, Benny Parks, when I sat with him, he, one thing, he said, oh, this is so nice. He just opened up the word. He said, well, this is obvious place to go and have like a, revelation, you're going to make it right one day. And he said, let's go to Romans 4. About Abraham. I feel like, but in verse 17, so Abraham was promised to be the father of nations and his offspring. And he's old, he's 100, and there's no hope, there's no chance. And so when it says that Abraham, in verse 17, in the God who he believed that God could give life to the dead and call into existence the things that he wanted to. Abraham had a faith that believed, even when there's nothing, there's no evidence, there's no hope, there's no hope. It says, in hope, he believes against hope. And he's like, Abraham believed that God could bring something to existence. had them. And that it gets what Peaceful had up. Talks about how he did not weaken in his state when he considered his own body or the like situation. No unbelief made him waver concerning the promise. And he was saying, it's not that he didn't have unbelief. But no doubt made him waver. At the end of the day, he stood in God's endurance and being able to keep peace at all. God can be anything at all. You know, and so that's what God did here with Samson. There was no request for mercy. There was no judge to be called. No person to prompt to move him in a better direction. God sent an angel and told a mama, I'm going to give you a miraculous baby. You can't even conceive children, but I'm going to help you conceive one. It's in every bit of it is miraculous and came out of nothing. So his mercy came out of nothing here. And just see, that's what God can do. That is what God can do with mercy. God's spirit was at work, and I know he said this last week. This is just one of the things about God again. His spirit was at work since before the earth began. He said this, it was hovering around the waters before creation. God's spirit was there. Through the Old Testament, time and time again, his spirit is at work. In this case, the spirit gives supernatural strength to stir up conflict and anger and power to begin a freedom for people in this little situation. But his spirit constant work, and it still is today. And his spirit indwells us, that the spirit has been at work in us. And then God showed mercy to Samson not only in how he used him for his purpose, but also in how he provided for him and sustained him. It's that common grace. He gave him common, at least, this extra grace to a non-Christian, but he did it. It was still accomplishing his purpose. And you think Samson didn't deserve grace? He's horrible. Even if God's going to use him, surely God wouldn't do nice things for him too. Yeah, he did. He gave him additional grace to sustain him, to provide for him, and he didn't do it. And all of it was because it was moving forward. So in God's mercy, he's a God of mercy. Above all else, he's a God, yes, of righteousness and justice, not just of justice. So I put on Irving, it's from Keller quote. The amazing truth is that God works through sinners and through sinful situations. He keeps his promises to bless the people in the dark and disastrous periods of our lives, as well as sometimes in things of our own. Not even our own sins will stop him from saving us. Amazing. Mysteriously and often unseen, and usually far beyond our comprehension, God works through the free and often flawed choice of people. It is that mystery that we are not robots, we are free agents, that God is using us. And so that's how we're going to kind of conclude. Romans 8:28 says, for we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him or call him. So he is working his purposes in all things. We feel the weight of what we don't know a lot of times, and so this is kind of how it ends. And I know that obviously, when I teach and pray, I know that my circumstances are shading everything, but I also just think that's what God's passages are doing. I'm like, I mean, that's what you're doing. Like, the ones that I'm teaching, like, is like, but it's just, it's been incredible how it does just, like, fit. It's like, this is for me. So we're like this. I think it's like, you know, you're like, that's a good study for me. Maybe not for y'all. So whereas we feel the weight of what we don't know, Scripture does give us great insight into what we do and what its purposes are. So its primary purpose, this is just a reminder, is the saving of our lives. He is behind the scenes working for the greater salvation. He had to prompt conflict for the Philistines to protect his people, to protect his offspring. The covenant promise is an offspring. All of the Old Testament is working towards protecting that covenant promise. All that is really worth that. He stirred up conflict to work to protecting that, because that offspring is going to be the salvation of his people. You know? So the purpose, he's working towards a greater salvation. Genesis 50:20, you know, in Joseph, in that particular example, it's great evil was done to him. He's sold by his slaves, and evil was done to him. But when he goes back and forgives them and tells them, as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant for good, for the saving of many lives, which is not written down. God used their sin to position Joseph in Egypt to work him up the place that he can provide them for the people of God. It's again, Israelites were at the brink of extinction because of the famine, but God had used some simple mess to behind the scenes move Joseph to now provide and to keep them from extinction. You know? And it says continually for the saving of many lives. He's doing that for the sake of the people. In Acts 2:23, Jesus, it says this Jesus, delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, was crucified and killed by the hands of God's hand. The greatest evil ever done was sent to Jesus, and that he was unfairly killed by he was put to death. And yet, God knows that, right? He prompted those people. He knew, he allowed that hardening and that stuff to punish his own son, to go and put his own son, because that was the kind of the greatest salvation. It's for the greatest salvation. Hebrews 11, that's the chapter of the Hall of Faith, and all these people, there's so much of it. Even St. Francis, there's so much, like, great miracles, great miracles, great miracles that God did here by faith, over, you know. And, you know, those last couple verses, it says, and then there were others. Who were tortured to death, who were sawn in two, who wandered in deserts, who did not receive their death after life. There's that whole group of others who didn't get the temporary miracle, and they didn't see the temporary victory. They suffered a lot. But it finishes the same, they also died in faith, believing that God had provided something for them. They did experience a better story. They didn't get the immediate salvation. They got a better and fuller. This is how we know we're doing. When no matter what we know God's doing, he's working with us. Is what is going on. Psalm 67, Revelation 7, 9, just remind us that when God says in this psalm, we talk about that his reign and the known on the earth, the salvation to all people. His primary purpose is the greater salvation that is going to include all of what he is protecting, not just all of but all of the people. Is raising together. So that Revelation 7, 9, when John says, behold, I work and I saw a great multitude that no one could count from every nation and tribe and people and language and gathered, so that that can happen. God's working towards that. Lots of secondary purposes are at work as well. These are just reminders that we know. We know Romans 8 and other places tell us that our conformity is to the image of the Son. That is the purpose God is always still doing. Huh? I didn't hear it. No, God's working to preserve and keep his covenant, his offspring, like he said. Now the covenant promise, okay, because it was to the offspring, so the whole Old Testament was toward like this, crescendoing to protect that offspring. The first covenant promise is for the offspring. It crescendoes to protect, do whatever God needs to protect that offspring. So now we're on the other side of it, the new covenant. So the covenant promise is to put the spirit in now, to change it. He says, I will need you to do my things. I will give you a new heart. He will keep us, and he will return to us. So he's still working all things towards his covenant promise of changing us, keeping us, and coming back to us. We know one of his purposes is because Jesus prays in his priestly prayer, Father, make them one, just as we are one. So there is a purpose at work to try to unify his people and bring about a unity that Jesus, if Jesus prays for that, that is a purpose at work. Isaiah 58 and Micah 6:8. Isaiah 58 is where it says the people are trying to fast and do these rituals. And Isaiah is a prophet speaking from God saying, is this, that's not the kind of fast I've chosen. The kind of fast I've chosen is this. Lose the chains of oppression. Break this place. Like, go help the poor to end oppression is to justice. He's saying, and provide justice for people who need it. So there's a part of God's purposes that are his will is justice, is to end oppression and to be people who love mercy. So I know I'm blind. 1 Thessalonians 5:16 says, in God's will for you is this, that you rejoice always. Take something new and good things. So secondary purposes. You know the greater salvation, that's happening, but also with the people mind on, he's preserving you, he's preserving you, he's bringing oneness to you, he wants to repent, but there's always rejoicing, there's justice in you out there. And then the last is just so that we can do knowing and believing and understanding that he is God. In Isaiah 43, this is Father Barker's life verse. Says, for you are my witnesses, my parents, and children, that you may know and believe and understand that he is God. So that's what he wants for us. It's a very reader, 17 for a lot. When Jesus prays about some gifts of eternal life, that they may know me, the one who is not perfect. Under the door, I do think the greater salvation is the primary overarching fantasy that always, all things, every moment, every sin, every wrong is being lead towards the greater salvation. But there's also going to be secondary, and the big final one is that there's also the rejecting, the knowing and understanding of the way that you see of God, you know, just that deeper knowledge of him as it works. So this was my favorite quote of last week from Paige Brown. I think I like posted it and like told everybody I've seen, but she says despair comes from fixating on what we don't know. Like Manoah was asking that angel, like, what are you gonna do with our son? How can we raise our son? How can we do it better? How can we, you know, what are your purposes? If you just kept thinking about, oh, you didn't tell me, I don't know, like that would be despair. Yes comes from fixing our mind on what we do. I've lived that so well. The fear comes from the fixation on what we don't know. That's something that we do. So his purposes, the very last one here, is of course, his purposes are not always evident. They can be hidden in the mess of the world. So they can be hidden, but they are being accomplished. And Ralph Davis did this little thing, and I was like, oh, so. In 1947, in the midst of World War II, you know, right? 47? Maybe. This is a thing I didn't find about exactly, but so there was this Italian named Ehud Avriel, which I think it was, who was searching for a ship who had this agenda and this mission. He was anti-Israel, anti-Jews, anti-Semitic, or something like that. He was searching for a ship who had wanted to transport goods into Palestine. So he had a not good mission, a bad mission. And to all eyes, his shipment was 600 tons of Italian onions. He's an Italian man. And he shipped onions. 600 tons of onions intentionally, because through that shipment he can hide things. Because he trusted, he banked on the fact that there's no customs agents are going to come and start to smell all 600 tons of these onions. They're going to get to a certain point and like, this is Italian onions. 600 tons. Okay, and so what he was sneaking into Palestine was Czech rifles, like weapons, into Palestine to be used against Jews. That was not a good mission, not what he put in. It was purpose for the Haganah, it was in. So unfortunately, his hidden purpose wasn't righteous, because God's not righteous. So that's a reverse story. God's hidden purpose is always righteous. Okay? But the point is, there's times when all we see and smell are the onions. And there is a fall for the onions. So all those people saw and smelled those onions, there was something bigger, much bigger going on. They're in the onions. They live in the onions, they nest. But the righteous and the bad purpose is getting hit in. So our takeaway this week is to rest. Rest in what you do know. Sit there in what you know to be true. I want enemies of rest. Whoever listens also, make a list. This is kind of more of like, instead of discussion, I think it's like actual homework assignment this week. But I feel like I really didn't get, like, make a list, take a journal, a piece of paper, and try to write, what do I know? And just go to the top, what do I know? And try to just pull a point, reminders to yourself, what do I know that I know that I know, you know? And then treasure it deep in your heart, because what we come to know in the light is going to be what we see in the light. And so, have it. She's done it a ton of times in the past, but do it again this week. What do I know? And it's a question of the idea. And any simple, there's nothing too simple to say that I know. And to yourself. So I did no discussion. I did a homework instead. Is that okay with you? I know. I know. So we work together. We talk. Oh, okay. She teaches at West End New Church, and I was a teacher church in Nashville. And she teaches so good. She's I've heard her say she's the best teacher in the PCA. Period. Male and female. I'm like, I think that's true. But she's so, like, she won't keep her stuff posted for long. And so she normally, like, will put up 1 week study. It's there for 1 week. She's going to study it. Well, last week was her fall break. And so she put 5 studies up. And said, so this week, I'm going to re-release 5 lessons. And so I listened to all 5 this week. because I've not been keeping up. So, you have to just get on an email list. Well, no, you get an email. They'll send you a link each week. West End Church has an email list. West. Ah, don't! So does Shelby. Y'all remember Shelby Eatrice, who they moved a couple years ago from here? They live in Nashville now, and she posted on my thing. Get everything. I'm like, even listening, I'm like, she goes in the work, but you're like, if you go through, then she illustrates it. She does the things Kathy do so well. Like, I'm like, she's very skilled also. It's like, not only incredible truth she pulls out, but she does it in a way that, like, her presentation is literally, like, very, very deep within a really funny illustration. But then she follows the thing, and I'm like, anyway, so I can help send y'all even toward those links. As in, I knew I was behind and I listened to five because I was like, I can't miss out on this. I'll never get to go back. I can't find them.
I think it has been such a good
And
I think it's
God has I don't think we'll do Thursday mornings again next spring because we don't think this time is necessarily a super beneficial time. We love y'all, but there's great other studies. We hopefully will do something.
It was a good
school time for them. Excuse me. I know I did too. I think I couldn't have.
Unless you saw.
The good news is we benefit from it. Yeah. We're only paying for any. We have 3 weeks left. Mm-hmm. We finished it then. Amanda finishes the whole book. It's just like flushing it down the toilet. And then I will come back and we'll see. You think me, but I think you can. And kind of give what you just take. We'll go back to the kind of takeaways, maybe more practical big picture versus put in the whole picture again. Just a matter before we end. Yes, and maybe in 3 weeks we'll know more of what next, we'll have what we have next.
Sure.
Father, thank you again. Thank you for your word. Thank you for saints. Thank you for your mercy and that you raise up from whatever you need to be your justice. You are always at work. You work for a greater salvation than we can fathom. God, and you use anything, messy anything, to help us to know you and to understand you more, God. Help us to see you. Help us to see. We need to fix our eyes and our hearts and our minds on what we do know. I pray that you would just give us clarity and just remind a little thing. Remember you know this. Remember, and you help us remember what we do know and just feel that deep down into our hearts and minds. Thank you again, God, that we can know you, that you've made yourself known. You took yourself known, that you did, not just through the general revelation of seeing your beauty in your work, but the specific revelation in your word. You tell us what we can know. Thank you. Thank you.